Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today from a very nice Vancouver morning, but one that promises to be a lead into a very wet week. Talking to you today as we start looking forward to the new year. The podcast has moved into 2020 volume, whatever that happens to mean. And as we've been doing for the past decade, the January issue is our special sort of flagship issue that we call the State of the Science. And every year, as those of you who have been reading them will know, we try to select a theme or special event and search for articles that really epitomize and summarize well where the field stands at that particular moment on some key and timely issues. This year's contribution to that series is one that we're calling Medical Education Mythology. It's an idea that Mohan Kulasekaram from the University of Toronto brought forward, where he suggested there are a lot of ideas out there that maybe require a bit closer scrutiny, because some of them really do seem to shade into mythology. Captivating notions that many people take up and that may not hold up to the close scrutiny of our expectations in this evidence-based world. We got some really great articles, and I'm looking forward to the release of the issue. The goal was in no instance to simply disprove the topic that's being identified, although I think that was effectively done in some cases, but rather what we're trying to encourage people to do was to consider some of those things that might fit into the realm of mythology and provide a critical analysis of whether it belongs there, whether it clearly isn't mythology, or whether it's still in that sort of gray zone in between. So today I have the pleasure of speaking with Joshua Haragi, who's one of the authors of one of those articles. He and his co-authors have a paper coming out called Generational Othering, The Myth of the Millennial Learner. Thanks, Joshua, for taking the time to chat.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
The pleasure's mine. This is an ideal example, I think, of what I was just trying to describe in terms of the goals we had for this special issue, for reasons that we'll try to work through as we talk. But just to get things started, as I alluded to in that introduction, we were looking for people to write on things that they thought deserved a closer look or some more critical scrutiny. Generational differences is something that impacts upon our field quite routinely. In fact, I think of all the proposals that we had submitted for this issue, generational differences was the thing that came up most often. What was it about that idea or the notion that there are generational differences that you found compelling enough to want to take a look at?
About 6 years ago, I was asked to give a presentation on how to teach to millennials. I think mostly because I was born in 1983, which makes me a millennial based on our most modern schema of generations. And in preparation for that talk, it was somewhat disconcerting to me that I couldn't find great literature or evidence to support a lot of the recommendations that I felt like I was compelled to make, because that was what was out there at the time in the HPE literature and accessible online. And so I was left with really asking the audience to question what it means to make recommendations to a whole generation of learners, but without really challenging them in a way that I think moved us forward. It was more of a moment for me, like, what do we do now? And so when the call for this issue came out, I was in this space of being kind of discontent with the state of the literature on generations and the many recommendations to teach to a specific type of generational learner, but I didn't know the way out per se. And so when we saw the call, myself and my colleagues decided to dive a little bit deeper into what this means, because it did really feel like a myth to us, and it was a great opportunity to really synthesize what we had been thinking about and really focus our energy towards moving the field forward and making recommendations such as, you know, moving from cultural competence in the past to cultural humility as a health professions discipline. And I think in the same way, this led us to really moving from this idea of we can competently understand and therefore come up with some new instructional strategies for a certain generation to developing more of a generational humility. And really, our goal has been to challenge people to critically examine all the assumptions we make when we are proposing new instructional strategies for our learners. Because as you said, the literature abounds with this idea of generations and millennial learners and how to teach to them best. And I think it is just going to continue as we keep moving forward with new so-called generations. I've been reviewing some abstracts that have proposals for how to teach to the next generation after the millennials. I think unless we challenge the myth, it'll perpetuate.
So for the sake of adding some context to those who maybe aren't as familiar with the claims that are out there, what sort of recommendations have you commonly seen for how we teach? Let's focus on millennials for the time being.
Yeah, I think it's good to focus on millennials since most of the literature has been relatively recent within the last decade or so. Therefore, it focuses mostly on millennials. And a lot of the literature really problematizes certain characteristics that they have, such as negative characteristics like entitled, and then also positive characteristics like they're really good at technology, or more neutral characteristics like they can multitask. They also include characterizations such as needing frequent feedback and praise, and because they are more familiar with technology, they need more online learning platforms, they need more hands-on learning and simulations. There's a number of recurrent recommendations. They all generally have the same if you look at them as a whole, mostly because they are based upon the work of a few.
Well, and in exploring that, one of the things I found appealing about the approach that you undertook was you went beyond simply trying to identify all the evidence that's out there and sort of do a meta-analysis or some other form of synthesis on it, but you took on the challenge of trying to better understand how the ideas of generational theory arise and get permeated through the health professional education literature. Do you mind telling our listeners a little bit about what you saw in those regards?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that. I think it's interesting because if you do look at the data that supports this idea of generational theory, that we can make broad assumptions based on when an individual was born, you know, the data is really mostly descriptive and anecdotal and largely based on one data set. But you're right, our goal wasn't necessarily to pick apart that data, or as you stated in the beginning, the goal of the issue is not necessarily to disprove ideas, but really to critically examine. And in this case, we were critically examining how we as a discipline in medical education, health professions education, really adopted this idea and let it permeate both our literature and our conferences. And I think if you look at a lot of our national conferences in health professions education, no matter the country with which they're in, there are an abundance of plenaries and abstracts that are presented based on how to teach to a certain generation. And so, especially in our literature, there's an abundance of this, both in health professional education conferences and literature, as well as in our specialty conferences and specific literature. And so we really were trying to understand how we adopted this, because if you look at the sociology literature, it's full of critiques, and they have, to the most extent, abandoned this idea of making broad assumptions and adapting your practices based on a certain generation, because it is really making large assumptions about a large group of people And in doing so, you ignore the considerable amount of individual variability that exists within a group. And so we were most concerned with this idea of adoption, because what does it mean for the future? How can we understand how we adopted this so that in the future we may be more careful and critical about adopting certain theories that may lead to bias and social prejudgments of our learners? Because it seems like most of the literature on recommendations on how to teach to millennials came about recently based on the work of Neil Howe and William Strauss, and they're pop sociologists who developed this generational schema that a lot of us are most familiar with, and wrote about millennials in the early 2000s. And then I think from there, the health professions education literature started picking it up and using it as a lens in which to recommend certain instructional strategies without critically examining the consequences of doing so. And I think it comes from a good place. I think that the goal was really to be more learner-centered and think about ways to adapt our teaching practices to our learners. Yet I think without being critical about it, what it can lead to is dehumanization of our individual learners. And we then develop these stereotypes about them that I think can lead to mistreatment, really based on the power differential that we have from our learners, both our power to write and develop ideas and then to make recommendations, and the power in our educational relationships to teach and to evaluate. And I think when you have already these differences in social spaces where one group has more power than another group, by applying a certain theory that makes broad generalizations of the group with less power, it easily leads to the application of stereotypes and stigma about your learners that may not really apply to the individual. And so we felt like really trying to understand that process of how we apply that in the HPE discipline was most important, rather than trying to disprove the data sets that are used to make the recommendations.
Really important distinctions and potential detrimental impacts of assuming these models, which again I think reinforces the importance of, not just for this issue but in general, of us to keep an eye out for mythologies where we might be misleading ourselves and harming our students or patients as a result. Which leads me to want to ask you more about sort of how we move forward from this. It's one thing to say maybe the generational models aren't fully accurate or may cause some problems if we adopt them. You mentioned it in your very opening comments, this notion of generational humility, and in the paper you spend a bit of time sort of speculating as to how we might move towards that. Can you explain the idea to those listening?
Absolutely. So we were, as authors, reminded of the idea of cultural humility in our research for this manuscript, and how it wasn't long ago where we were teaching and writing about how we should be culturally competent in order to be more patient-centered in our care. And then we realized as a discipline that what this can lead to is dehumanization of our patients and making broad assumptions about them rather than seeing the individual. And therefore it shifted from cultural competency to cultural humility. And I think we see parallels of that here, in that we need to be reflexive about the power dynamics that we have and the power differentials that we have from our learners, similar to how healthcare providers have a power differential between themselves and their patients, and be humble about how we may apply certain theories to our teaching and assessment contexts so that we continually examine the assumptions we are making about our learners when we do so. I think really what it is a call to just be reflexive about our power differentials and understand that it does take a lot of work and courage and resilience to always evaluate the assumptions we make whenever we're applying theories in health professions education, in order so that we can really rehumanize our learners and adjust our teaching and assessment practices based on best evidence and good instructional strategies based on best practices within medical education rather than on sweeping generalizations of our learners. And I think in doing so, we will not necessarily come to different teaching practices. I think a common criticism that may occur with the paper is that, well, I've applied this generational theory and it makes sense to me and it's led to teaching practices that do have evidence. And I think the challenge there is that the end result might be the same in terms of how you're going to change your instructional practices, but the reason you're doing so may be based on the generational theory and its assumptions about a large group of people, which can lead to stereotypes about individuals, rather than basing it on good evidence on how we understand all learners learn best, or how we should best teach to all our learners, both within generations and across generations.
That notion of reflection and reflective practice seems like a very good description of this effort at multiple levels. You're pointing to it as a way of continuing to critically develop as we interact with learners of multiple generations, and it's a good description of what you've modeled in putting this paper together in terms of trying to figure out what are the good that we can take away as educational practices and society and technology evolve, and how do we avoid overgeneralizing and turning those things into rules that maybe can't be maintained and might cause some damage. So I think that's actually the best place we could end on, because it does encourage people to go read the article for more detail and terms of how you've modeled that reflective process and put together a very insightful piece that reminds us yet again about how problematic it can be to lump groups of individuals together in stereotypical ways.
I just wanted to add a personal story. When I applied to medical school, I interviewed with the dean of admissions at the medical school I ultimately went to in October in California, in a time when I was much more casual than I am now. I showed up in an orange tie and orange flip-flops, orange sandals. I also had long hair at the time. I was very ignorant to what it meant to dress professionally for a certain interview. I grew up more disadvantaged and wasn't familiar with those types of social spaces and the expectations that came with it. And the dean of admissions called me a month later and asked me to reconcile the quality of my overall application with the fact that I wore sandals to my interview. And needless to say, I didn't have a great response. But he told me at that time, and reiterated recently after he saw this paper, that he could see that although I wore sandals, didn't have a rebellious attitude toward convention or professionalism, and saw the potential in me to become a physician. And I think that is really powerful for me to reflect on, because it's easy, I think, to take these characterizations of millennials as narcissistic, entitled, too casual, and really apply them to all the individuals we see as belonging to that group of people. And I think if that dean had done that to me, I definitely wouldn't have gone into medical school. And I think it's interesting to look at it through the lens of Dr. Glenn O'Day's companion piece as well, in terms of what are our core values and what are our teaching practices and what can we change as society changes, and how our learners are joining a new profession or assuming a new identity. And part of it is we have to enculture them to the way of being a physician or healthcare provider and what that means and what are our core values that never change. And how is that different from, say, the teaching practices that should change? And so seeing our learners both as individual humans, we need to understand and come to with humility and understand where they're coming from and the culture with which they're bringing with them, but also the responsibility of enculturing them to the way of being a physician. And I forever will be indebted to that dean who saw how he could enculture me to the way of being a physician, but that I also wasn't coming with a spirit of disrespect that might have been easily attributed to me if you looked at it through the lens of generational theory.
Very interesting. Always nice to add a little bit of color like that to the issues that we're talking about. So thank you for raising that, and thank you for mentioning Glenn Regehr's commentary as well. It also will be in the January 2020 issue, but the paper that we've been discussing today is the one that prompted that commentary. You'll find it under the title Generational Othering, The Myth of the Millennial Learner. And the voice you've been hearing describe it is from the University of Washington, Joshua Haragi, who's in emergency medicine there. So thank you very much, Joshua. I certainly appreciate you giving up some time during your busy morning and wish you the best of luck as you continue to explore some of these ideas.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.